I think this is really cool. What do you guys think about this?
So I think, first of all, delete Facebook like any other rational human being should do. We'll throw that out there.
Oh, well, there are a number
there's
of...
There's only a billion people on there.
There are a number of interesting side thoughts from your little description there.
Yeah.
One of which is that the next time you say the phrase, be creative about content, I'm going to push you into a well.
So when you're creating content and you're coming up with ideas, how would you describe that?
I would never create content. I might write a book, for example.
Well, that's creating content, you idiot.
I mean, that's content creation, yeah.
No, not really. Why do you need a generic term for it? It's stupid.
Think of it this way, nerd boy. Creating content is a... writing a book is a subclass of creating content.
Stop using the word content. It's a meaningless marketing word.
Of all the places I thought we would land in this discussion, I'm going to be honest.
You just don't like people using the word content. That's what's happening here.
That's absolutely correct. But I do think it's interesting.
Content.
Content creation.
This is great content working on. When I'm creating content, for example, I just want to watch it.
You are such an unutterable oaf. Honestly.
I don't know why. I don't know why this bothers you so much. Anyway, so when I'm in the zone making content, what I often do is I write, if I'm building a training course, for example, I'll write things down onto index cards because then I can reorder them in different ways, right?
And this seems like a suboptimal way of interacting with the content that I've been presented with.
Would you agree that that's great content?
I'd agree that it was great.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Bad Voltage, Season 3, Episode 13, the lucky episode, I imagine. My name is Jeremy. I'm joined by Jonathan Edward James Bacon III and Stuart Langridge.
Hooray!
How's the third?
How's everyone doing today?
I need to have a word with my mum.
He's the one, the only Jono Bacon.
There is only one, hopefully. So we're going to talk about old tech, new tech. We're going to talk about whether... taking time away from computers and screens and stuff like that with writing things down is a good thing. And also whether technology is coming out to make that easier. And it's actually going to quite...
Can we find a way of taking time away from screens by giving you a different screen to use instead?
It's basically Etch-a-Sketch as a service.
We're also going to talk about how amazing content is. There's going to be lots of great content in this show.
Shut
up. There will be content creation.
And with this content, we're going to cross the line of super credibility.
I am still
have not heard that one in a while.
Disappointed. We may even become about the Wikipedia thing with that.
What's that?
where we were sat in a pub in Edinburgh, the three of us, Matt Garrett, someone else, and we edited your Jono Wikipedia page to say that you were a super credibility consultant.
I forgot about this.
And then someone noticed it and immediately reverted it, and we were all very sad about it.
Your massively transformational purpose is now known.
Was this Matthew Garrett? Was he the ringleader for this particular exercise?
Sounds like something he would do. So
it does sound like something he would do.
Do you remember when Lug Radio sponsored the Guadec party in Birmingham? And we were all in the bar hanging out, and I went to the bar to buy him a drink. I came back, and someone told me, laughing, it might have been you, Ak, that he'd eBayed my back.
I'd forgotten that.
And I looked on eBay, and there's a low-quality 320 by 200 phone picture of my back on eBay.
I'd forgotten
about
that.
And it's like $1.99.
Oh, man. I'd utterly forgotten that you did that. Yeah, that's fantastic.
And now.
All right. So what have we got that's amusing, Mr. Langridge?
Well, the first one, and I feel like this is one which deserves a comment from the connoisseur third of the show, Jeremy. Apparently, yes. Taco Bell now make their own wine.
I read about this yesterday.
Legitimately don't know what to do with this.
It says Taco Bell Canada said in a release the duo of jalapeno noir, which is the wine, and the new toasted cheesy chalupa.
The word tantalizing is
alarming. It's irresistible, apparently, and the rich taste and crunchy texture of the beloved toasty cheesy chalupa complements notes of wild strawberry, cherry and beetroot in this silky limited edition red wine.
Cannot make that up.
Now, I'm slightly disappointed to discover that this is only actually in Canada. But, Jeremy, you live well close to Canada. I feel like some kind of cross-border COVID-defying trip to obtain a bottle
of this. I was going to say, unfortunately for me, it says this wine will not be sold in the United States, even though the same chalupa will roll out in November. But I feel like it is possible I will somehow covertly sneak into Canada, go to Taco Bell, get this wine, come back, and it will all have been worth it.
Who's shocked, by the way, that the jalapeno noir fine red wine will not be sold in the United States, but the toasted cheesy chalupa will in fact be rolled out across the nation?
I have two questions about the toasted cheesy chalupa. First of all, I don't know what a chalupa is.
It's a small, it's like a small dog. The look on his face.
So what actually is it?
It's a taco. It's a different type of taco.
Oh, right, okay, fine. And secondly, yeah. I don't understand how it's simultaneously a new product and beloved, which is how they described it.
My favorite part about this was I learned Kellogg sold a boxed red wine called House Wine. You were supposed to pair it with Cheez-It snacks early this year. The product was in response to customer demand that often mixed the two.
Oh, my God. What? That's
Wow. I read a thing, right? Apparently, wine and cheese don't actually go together. The 70s completely lied to us. You're not really? Actually supposed to... apparently, I thought it seemed like a big pitch given the existence of the country of France. But, apparently you're not supposed to have wine and cheese together. But... different piece of news, right? US Customs and Border Protection seized a bunch of counterfeit Apple AirPods that were being brought into the country, into Nevada.
This is beautiful.
And tweeted about them and saying, yeah, these aren't Apple. Look how proud we are that we've seized all these counterfeit AirPods. And it turns out, yeah, they're not AirPods, but they're completely legitimate OnePlus wireless earphones. they weren't even slightly intended to be a knockoff.
No, my favorite part about this one is OnePlus simply replied on Twitter, hey, give those back.
Really?
So whoever runs the OnePlus social media, kudos to you.
Yeah, gold star for you. That's really very good.
They are really good.
Like, you could imagine that poor like Customs and Border Protection person being so excited to tell the boss about this amazing discovery, and then it gets revealed that this is just
the thing that's odd is the front of the box in giant letters says OnePlus Buds.
Yeah,
right.
I know. I'm assuming that when the new iPhone comes out, they'll bust a big shipment of them for being knockoff Pixel 6s.
Right. Yeah, the first rule of counterfeiting is you've got to put the brand that you're trying to imitate on the box, right? Is that how it's supposed to work?
I don't know.
I'm not brilliant at this.
I want to share something very quickly. It's not funny, but I just thought it was quite cool. That just jumped into my head. We've talked about the PlayStation 5 recently, which is going to be coming out in November.
You have talked about that, yes.
There's been this ongoing war between Microsoft and PlayStation. I read on Bloomberg yesterday that PlayStation is struggling to make enough of them because of COVID and getting the components for the PS5s. But they've made quite a few of these, and they're worried about how long it's going to take to ship them from China to the US. And I read yesterday that apparently they're renting 60 747 jets from Delta, and they're going to be shipping them over air freight. And some guy on Reddit went and figured it out, and that's 3 million PlayStation 5s are going to be put in airplanes and shipped over to the US. I just thought that was kind of a cool little statistic.
You know, that's quite cool.
Yeah. Pretty very serious situation. You know, they, just so you know, U.S. Border Customs and Border Protection. These are not knockoff Xboxes.
They're fake Xbox One X, One Xbox, or whatever they're called.
Right, 101 XXX One. Very easy branding. Anyway, what's next?
And then the final thing, which is both funny and rather lovely, I thought. Have you seen this thing that Dave Grohl's doing with Nandi Bushell?
Yes.
This is great. So for those of you who haven't seen it, Nandi Bushell is a 10-year-old girl from Ipswich in the UK. And she's a pretty good drummer. I mean,
She's great.
Let's go over to our drumming correspondent, Jono Bacon. I think she's a good drummer. What do you think?
She is, in fact, a great drummer. The other young drummer on YouTube is this guy called Avery something. It's amazing how good some of these kids are. So, very good drummer.
So, I'm not actually sure how it got started. She did a drumming video and challenged Dave Grohl or something.
Right.
And then Dave Grohl responded. And they've been going backwards and forwards having a drum battle. And as of about a day ago from, or maybe even less than that, from when we're recording this, Dave Grohl has conceded defeat in the first round and then come back with his challenge for the second round, which is this whole song Dave Grohl did with his family, with loads of drumming and his family singing backing vocals about how cool this girl is and how she's the queen of rock and roll. And it's just so heartwarming.
Yeah, I Dave Grohl seems like such a dude.
He really does seem like a cool guy, I have to say. Yes.
There's this amazing video on YouTube talking about Dave Grohl where the Foo Fighters were playing somewhere, and there was this young guy in the audience who was wearing like Kiss makeup, long hair, holding a big sign that said, "Let me get up and play." What was that famous song? Monkey Wrench, I think it's called. Holding this big sign. So Dave Grohl brings him up onto the stage and gives him a guitar, and he plays Monkey Wrench with the Foo Fighters. And this guy is a fucking shredder. Like, he just nails it. And the crowd are going absolutely nuts. You should go and check out that video. It's incredible. So kudos to Dave Grohl. That's, like him.
There's little things. There's a bunch of videos on YouTube of random famous musicians just dropping in on a busker. Or something like that. There's one with Jimmy Somerville out of the Communards and Will I Am out of the Black Eyed Peas. It just, you know, he's just like walking along the street in London and there's a busker there who's actually playing one of his songs. So he just goes up and goes, "Do you mind if I jam you?" And this guy's like, "Oh, okay."
Iron Maiden crashed a wedding in the 80s when they were on tour with like the Power Slave album and played the wedding.
Ed Sheeran's done it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Just shows up at like some random working men's club in the middle of nowhere and plays a gig with someone. It's really
He seems to be a dude as well. You know,
he seems very down to earth. He's either got the mother of all PR teams working for him putting this over, or he really is a really just nice, down to earth Irish guy.
It's funny, he's English, by the way.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, thought he was Irish. Okay.
He's a ginger. I think that's what we assumed that.
This was my assumption.
I honestly thought it was Irish as well. Although our 7-year-old boy, his favourite song is Shape of You by Ed Sheeran, and which is a song about two people basically getting jiggy with it, and Jack doesn't quite understand the meaning of the song yet. So, speaking of getting jiggy with things, should we talk about Oracle?
Yes. Well, only that briefly, I think.
Not a smooth segue, for the record.
It was not. Being more serious.
No, it wasn't good.
And this is the bit where I ask you two, both of whom will have done the reading and the research, to explain this to me. So Oracle are buying TikTok, apparently, except maybe they're not buying TikTok, or maybe they are, and I don't understand what's going on.
So this is where I explain to the dear listeners that in the 20 or 36 to 48 hours in between now when we are recording this and when it's released, all of the information will have come out and we have access to none of that information now. So I suspect we'll talk about this a little bit more in depth next show. But as it stands now, Microsoft has bowed out. They're calling this a technology partnership, and I legitimately, with no further definition, I don't know how to interpret
I don't know what that means.
But it seems to me like it's some kind of Oracle is going to agree to host some of the data, I'm imagining. Interesting, because ByteDance just signed a very large 3-year deal with Google and is already in AWS. So it's going to be their third cloud, which will be interesting to watch unfold. But it seems like they're going to move forward, but with what? I am not sure. I don't imagine Elson thinks he's running TikTok. And it's been made pretty clear by the Chinese government that in no uncertain terms, they are not allowed to give up the algorithm. And I think, to me, the algorithm is really where the national security component was. Not the data residency is a thing, but to me, a minor thing. The algorithm is the major thing. The thing that is a lot different about TikTok than traditional social media is there's no social network component, right? It's not your friends don't surface things for you. The app just surfaces things. And because of that, they can interject a lot of things and make whatever they want popular. And given the misinformation that's going around these days, that's obviously a concern with an app that has the kind of download numbers and retention numbers that TikTok has. So the thing that we should have cared about was the algorithm, and it seems like that slid under unnoticed. So I'm very curious to find out what happens in the next, I don't know, week or so as the details come out. But I suspect this will be an interesting story that we want to discuss when we have a little bit more information.
Yeah, the impression I had about the thing is everyone seems to be fighting over their definition of what, or way of describing what's being done. But what's being done doesn't seem to be changing that much, right?
So what's being done, for me, why part of the story is so fascinating is that I've never seen a situation where the leader of a country forced the sale of a private entity in this way. So the whole way that this played out, and then Microsoft coming out and saying that they would in some way remunerate the United States Treasury, which also doesn't make any sense and is unprecedented on top of it. Like the number of moving components here, and then having the Chinese government step in and say, well, they can't sell the algorithm. It's not for sale. It really shows the fact that out of all the geopolitical things that could have turned into the hot button thing, the fact that it's TikTok to me is a little fascinating and that so both governments are so invested in this transaction means it's going to be a details coming out of this if not for weeks, months. So something we'll keep an eye on, and definitely something I'm personally interested in, so we'll I'm sure talk about it more as we get more.
I suspect once the stagger unwinds, this is a whole main topic.
Yes, but I would imagine. Yeah. So.
At the moment, no one has a clue, including all the people involved in it.
I was going to say, I suspect when you say no one, you mean legitimately no one, including the people signing the paperwork. So
it seems fascinating as well that, I mean, we'll find out what's going on, but the idea of some kind of technology partnership with TikTok when it comes to infrastructure seems eminently reasonable that Oracle will be interested in that. But if it turns out that Oracle are buying them for the purposes of they will own them like Microsoft would own them, and it's a consumer product that people can use, that is just mind-bogglingly obtuse to me. It's just like, why would that be
so the what case? It's not going to be that. What I would guess is there'll be some agreement where maybe Oracle owns the developer accounts with Apple and Google, but not in China. But not having access to the algorithm, I don't know how they would actually sign the app. So there's still...
I have already seen someone post a thing to Twitter, which I'm assuming is a mock-up of the TikTok screen with the now you have to install Java pop-up on top of it. I mean, I can't categorically guarantee this is not just an actual thing that it does now, but I'm assuming it's a Photoshop job.
People talk so much shit about all the problems with social media. We talk so much shit about it as well, but goddamn, the internet can deliver sometimes.
Let's talk about the other enormous potential technology acquisition.
The other could be an entire show news item. Yes.
Yes. And this may become a news item in the future, depending on what happens. So, NVIDIA are buying ARM.
Yes.
Thoughts? I've got a bunch, but go ahead.
From my perspective, ARM's entire business model was predicated on making the ARM ecosystem as good as possible for as many entities as possible so that they could sell as many licenses as possible, right? So in that way, ARM's business model really enabled a diverse, thriving market of ARM devices. And that's, I think, for a lot of reasons why you see ARM chips proliferating so much. And I will grant that RISC-V is on their coattails, and there's a whole separate argument there.
There's a whole section of this about RISC-V, which is coming up.
In the end, ARM's business objective pre-acquisition was to create and empower as many direct competitors to NVIDIA as possible. Right, there's no other way to put that. So that neutrality under NVIDIA's ownership, I don't know how they maintain that. They're claiming that they're going to, but now NVIDIA has early access to ARM designs. They can modify the ARM ISA in any way they want. They're now a supplier for their direct competitors, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Samsung set a great precedent here.
I could say
they're
Samsung.
The number one Android phone manufacturer, and yeah. Also give the displays to Apple for the iPhone. So. And I think Samsung has a rich history of that kind of enablement. NVIDIA's reputation, both on the pricing side and on the being a little adversarial on the partnership side,
I don't know
that kind of ecosystem will be there. But if you listen to their CEO in the earnings report talking about this, he seems all in. Whether NVIDIA will change who they are, which is what this would take, I don't know.
I couldn't agree more with you about that. And there are a couple of extra components to this from my point of view. So I was listening to Bill Cook talking about this, and he expressed my thoughts very well. ARM are a UK company, and there aren't that many of them who are world. I don't care about your
SoftBank.
opinion.
they were owned by SoftBank.
UK company in Cambridge, blah, 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 right?
Yeah, but the heart and soul of ARM is definitely Cambridge. There's no doubt about that.
And NVIDIA have said, no, we're not going to change that. We're not going to move all the operations to the US. And here's the thing, much like you, Jeremy, on the, we're going to continue to enable our competitors. When they say, it's all going to remain the heart and soul of it's in Cambridge and we're not going to fiddle with that. I'm like, okay, but here's the thing. I don't believe you. And I just don't.
Why not?
I'm sure they won't do anything for 2 or 3 years.
Sure. As with all these promises, when acquisitions happen.
But it's what happened. So it's disappointing because they go away from here. It's disappointing because they're a homegrown thing. And as an Acorn kid, I have a special attachment to ARM, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I can't see how this can be anything other than harmful to the ARM ecosystem. I mean, what can NVIDIA add to this that ARM weren't already in a position to do? Is what I don't get. I mean, I'm prepared to buy that for the moment it doesn't make things any worse, but I don't see how it improves things. The only direction is down, right?
I mean, that's a good question, but I would argue that one thing that NVIDIA's figured out to a reasonable degree is how to build components that can be sold to a mass market of people and how to get their components into other devices. And maybe their idea here is making ARM...
If you buy a charging lead, it's got an ARM chip in it.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean... but that doesn't necessarily mean that ARM are good at that. What I'm saying is that...
But ARM didn't have to be good at it. It was the point because they never built anything. They just licensed the designs.
Right. Well, TSMC built it or whomever built it.
ARM. But what I'm saying is that you're asking, what can NVIDIA do that's beneficial here? I would say that... I think... Everybody would agree that ARM's technology is great and it's impressive, and NVIDIA have done great things elsewhere. And it seems like that, at least from what I've been reading, the main goal here is going to be around AI. I don't know. I don't know enough about either to have a really, frankly, a warranted view on this. But I just think they're two good companies operating in close but different areas, and I can imagine them actually generating some really pretty interesting shit out of this.
I think the thing that's going to worry people and would worry me from a making the acquisition fruitful or however you want to word it perspective is their business models are not aligned in any way.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
If you're someone in finance, you would say there's not a lot of synergy here. So I don't know.
It's another trigger word for Eck.
the CEO, that's why I said it. If you listen to the CEO talk, he's almost acting like it's a reverse merger and that suddenly NVIDIA is going to take on the DNA that ARM built. And I don't see that happening, to be honest. No. One thing that fascinated me is if you look at when SoftBank bought ARM, NVIDIA, which was not long ago, it was 2016.
Yeah.
NVIDIA market cap was about $34-ish billion, depending on if you go when it was announced or when it closed, et cetera. But in the mid-30s, they're worth $300 billion now. So the fact that they paid for this in stock is
And ARM just got bought for only $4 billion more than they were bought for at that point. So yes, NVIDIA,
the return was less than 5% for SoftBank. Yeah.
Yeah. NVIDIA have got way more.
Hang on, Jeremy. Let me be sure I heard that right. You're saying that NVIDIA was worth about $30 billion in 2016. Is that right? And now they're worth $300 billion? Is that what you said?
If you include the massive bump that they got after announcing this, yes.
Wow. That's fucking incredible.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Jesus. One's a big deal. And ARM have done nothing like that. I mean, no. I'm sure there are a bunch of reasons why NVIDIA can see that this is good for NVIDIA. I just don't think it's going to be good for ARM. But what I think's interesting is the small groundswell about RISC-V chips has been there for a while. People talk about SH and that kind of thing, super original. But yeah, RISC-V seems to be the thing, which could be the new ARM. But yep. There's always been this slight sense of, yeah, this is all great, but why would anyone ever care about this? In order for this to happen, it's not like you're going to topple ARM by being better. The ARM people are going to have to just shoot themselves in the foot so that there's a place to be taken. And I wonder whether this is precisely that thing.
I would imagine there will be an uptick in investment. I mean, one of the big differences is there's no license fee with RISC-V, right? So yeah. That would have been the initial pitches, especially for very low cost things like charging cables.
No
license fee helps. For a phone, less of a big deal.
Yeah.
But I think this will accelerate the investment companies will have in the architecture in general.
Yeah, I think there will be a bunch of people who before were quite happy to be ARM licensees, quite happy to just think in terms of, we'll just use ARM chips for everything, who are now like, oh, now we've got to buy them off NVIDIA. Maybe we're not as keen.
And the thing about ARM is that they were willing to do a couple of different areas where they had their regular processor designs that you could just buy. And then they worked, Apple could take it and do the Bionic thing and make it one of the best chips around. I'm skeptical that NVIDIA is going to want to do that second thing, right? When you buy an NVIDIA chip, you buy Tegra. You don't get a lot of options. Where ARM was all about options and modifiability. And then, Global Foundry will build you whatever you want from there. It won't matter. So it was that modularized ecosystem that I think was what made ARM. And that's just anathema to what NVIDIA does and how they operate as an organization.
I certainly think if 10 years from now, RISC-V is a big thing, it's supposed to be
pronounced. This was the watershed moment?
I think people will look back in there how we got this far, and this will be one of the points on the table of contents.
Yeah.
None of this is going to shake out for years. NVIDIA aren't going to start doing the things we're worried they might do for 2 or 3 years at least. That's going to take a while to filter into the market, so on and so forth. So maybe it's nothing. But I just feel like I wish this hadn't happened.
But, I mean, why? Like, let's...
Because he's an acorn... He is a self-described acorn kid.
Right, I get that, but to me, that's an emotional response to a situation as opposed to a logical evaluation of the situation.
Yeah, but here's the things, right? Emotional responses are okay. They're allowed.
I'm not saying it's not okay, but you know what is wrong? You know, the problem with emotional responses many times is they're flawed. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't be. I mean, we all emotionally respond to everything, right? I just don't think a company is going to go and spend $40 billion on ARM. And then the thing that makes ARM so... One of the reasons why ARM has been so successful is because of that licensing piece, that modularity piece. I just think, I mean, NVIDIA are a lot of things, but we're assuming that NVIDIA are never going to change. And I think companies do, often companies will buy other companies so they can have a bit of a sea change to occur. Now, I'm not saying it's not going to reflect poorly ultimately on ARM, but it may reflect really well on ARM. It may mean that ARM are going to be able to do things that they were never able to do before because they've got this big machine behind them.
Serious question. I'm not disagreeing with you. Can you give an example of one company who's bought another with the intention of that prompting a sea change where it successfully happened? I can name a couple where they're trying to do that. IBM buying Red Hat, Microsoft buying GitHub, but we're still in the early stages. That transformation hasn't occurred. They're hoping that it occurs, and maybe NVIDIA are doing the same thing with ARM here. Do you know of an example where they did that and it worked? There may be one. I'm not saying there isn't one. I can't think of one.
I'd say Sun buying MySQL.
Oof, I would not agree with that. So I would say Apple buying Next.
Apple buying Next, good example.
Do you think when Apple bought Next, what they bought was Next culture, or do you think they just bought Steve Jobs?
Bit of both.
A bit of both.
Yeah.
and the Steve Jobs that came back was not the Steve Jobs that left, so I don't even know if they knew what they were buying.
No, agreed. Those are reasonable examples. I'll go for those.
And I know that they're ongoing, but I think Microsoft buying GitHub is a brilliant example of this happening.
Totally.
You know, so I think, look, NVIDIA, given, I don't know a huge amount about what they've been doing, but they have had an amazing amount of success, obviously, in the last two or three years. They're doing something right. They're understanding the markets they want to get into, and they're doing it well. I just think that it's easy for us to say they're just a big company, they're going to fuck it all up, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. We'll see what happens. I think people are fair to be suspicious. I think people are fair to have their suspicious thoughts about it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. If you are to say, but they're a big company, they'll fuck it up, and someone goes, well, why do you think that? You go, well, how long do you want to wait for me to reel off examples of this happening?
Right.
But I agree with you completely. I mean, maybe we should give them the benefit of the doubt. And it'd be interesting to see, because I tend to think of ARM as being quite an open company and NVIDIA as not being quite an open company. But I don't know how much of that's actually true.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to see how they blend together. It'd be interesting to see whether the risk-free stuff ends up becoming the next big thing.
Well, and the other thing as well I'd say is, it's just as a general way of, I think, in which we all look at the world, it's easy for us, for example, to say, look at all these companies who fucked up, and we can reel off, like the three of us could reel off loads of them, of areas in which people have fucked up. But I think people often remember the newsworthy fuck-ups. But the really good stuff that's happening doesn't get news in the same way that people have said this about the news a lot, right? You always hear about the murders and the rapes and the terrorist attacks and whatever else, but you don't hear the thousands of good, kind stories that are happening every day because it's not newsworthy. So just because we hear the fuck-ups with some of these companies doesn't necessarily mean they're not doing a lot of good stuff. We just maybe haven't heard of it. So we'll have to see what happens. I mean,
yeah, well, Time will tell. We revisit this in a couple of years when
they fucked it up.
Every charging cable I buy has a different chip.
You can look forward to season 5, episode 80, where we cover the retrospective on this one.
Yeah, we'll talk about this and we'll review the Remarkable 2 tablet. Boys and girls, I have a story to share with you all. So recently I was laid in bed. And I was browsing Instagram of all places, which I don't tend to look at very often because I'm over 40 now.
Are you an influencer now?
Yeah, that's right. I am. I'm an influencer.
Absolutely not.
I have not influenced anything or anyone. Anyway, so I'm kind of going through Instagram. I saw an ad for something called a Remarkable tablet. And I'd heard about this a little while back. And it's basically, it looks like an ebook reader, right? Like it's got that grayish kind of e-paper screen. But it's got a pencil with it and you can draw on it and you can draw notes. And it's basically designed to replace like a typical notepad. And this really resonated with me because I don't know about you two, but I when I need to come up with ideas or get creative about content or my business or whatever else, I tend to go outside now with a piece of paper and a pencil, and I tend to scratch down on ideas on paper, and I can reorganize them and move them around. So this idea of this remarkable tablet was really interesting to me, and I ended up buying one. But then I realized that I think we're seeing a bit of a trend happening here, because I've also discovered about myself that I'm starting to buy real books, and I like to sit outside with a book and a cup of coffee instead of sitting there with my Kindle Oasis. So this all begs the question, are we seeing this kind of resurgence of tech enabling non-tech things? You know, because not only the remarkable tablet, when I was doing some digging, I also found some company. This thing looks crap, to be fair. And it's a typewriter with an e-ink screen. It's got like one of those old school cherry keyboards with the clicky keys on it and some crappy little e-ink display.
You did not put this in the show notes.
I thought, I shared it to you guys in Slack. I'm going to go and dig it up so you can go and see it. But this notion of technology enabling you to get away from notifications and Facebook and Twitter and people rowing about politics and the internet, I think this is really cool. What do you guys think about this?
So I think, first of all, delete Facebook like any other rational human being should do. We'll throw that out there straight away.
There's only a billion people on there.
There are a number of interesting side thoughts from your little description there.
Yeah.
One of which is that the next time you say the phrase be creative about content, I'm going to push you into a well.
So when you're creating content and you're coming up with ideas, how would you describe that?
I would never create content. I might write a book, for example.
Well, that's creating content, you idiot.
I mean, that's content creation, yeah.
No, not really. Why do you need a generic term for it? It's stupid.
It's the act of writing a book. Think of it this way, nerd boy. So creating content is writing a book is a subclass of creating content.
Stop that using the word content. It's a meaningless marketing
word. Of all
word.
The places I thought we would land in this discussion, I'm going to be honest,
you just don't like people using the word content. That's
correct.
What's happening here.
That's absolutely correct. But I do think it's interesting.
Content.
Content creation.
This is great content.
You say your notion is about tech enabling non-tech uses. But I think there's a whole bunch of non-tech uses which keep coming back. I mean, there was a thing maybe 15 years ago when PDAs were a big thing. So this would have been just before the first smartphones or after the first smartphones, depending on your definition of what a smartphone is, but before the first iPhone. There was
You're not talking about people kissing in public, right?
Oh, yes, PDAs, yes. I thought...
That one took a while to land.
It did for two reasons. First of all, and secondly, the whole idea of people kissing in public or fraternizing in public or being closer than 6 meters apart in public is so foreign to me now that I just don't think of it anymore. Right. Speaking of someone who hasn't touched another human being for 6 months.
Right. Just himself. Anyway,
moving on.
Let's move on. That's not good content.
There was a thing around about 2005 or so called the Hipster PDA, and it was one of these 9-day wonder things on whatever we did before Twitter, where we found things out. I don't even remember. But basically, as people were starting to carry PDAs around and say, I keep my notes on them and I use them in meetings and so on, there was a little bit of an anti-tech backlash against them, and people were pushing for the idea of a hipster PDA, which was just a bunch of index cards kept together with a bulldog clip. And it was one of those slightly trendy, hipstery things to have, where the same way people will say have a Moleskine notebook, that they're very proud that they keep notes in it rather than on their iPhone or whatever. Yep. So I think there's this kind of emotional pull towards, I don't know whether it's authenticity or just the fact that a bit of paper never ever goes bing in the middle of an important piece of work and needs charging or whatever.
I think that's what it's all about.
But then your thing has all the disadvantages of both, right? I mean, what does it... What? I'm assuming the point is that what it gives you is that you don't have to carry a whole ream of paper around and you can keep using it.
Yep. Yeah.
Right.
And so, digitizes it as well.
As far as I can tell, it's a screen that you can write on with a pencil, and it works by kind of, you know, the way e-paper works is sort of magnets and little turny balls under the covers. So it's basically a magna doodle is what this thing is, but for the 21st century.
Yeah, but it's an e-magna doodle. Okay.
Americans and other benighted members of the populace who may not have come across the classic toy that is a magna doodle. Think of an etch-a-sketch, except you could draw on it with a sort of magic magnetic pencil. I'm sure you had them. I just don't know what it was called.
Yeah,
and your thing is just that, right?
Does it freedom give you, doodle?
Does it give you actual text?
So the way it works is, it's a screen.
I know you can put notes on it and so on. From reading
you can write in it. So you know you can break it into different notepads.
It does OCR
notebooks. It'll convert your scribblings into.
Is the OCR any good? Is my question.
So
I know it claims to do it.
So I've pre-ordered mine, and mine doesn't arrive until November. But the first batch of these has started shipping, and from everything that I've seen on extensive review videos on YouTube, that the OCR is actually pretty good.
I should be impressed if you can read your illiterate chicken scratch that is handwritten. I can't read it. Let alone a Python script.
I can't read it. The Python script. Oh, and also this thing runs Linux. And what's quite cool is that people have been building like their own new features into this remark. Apparently, it's very, very hackable.
That's
which is
nice.
Cool.
So I will say, when you described this initially, I thought to myself, that sounds dumb. And then I looked at the website, and it actually is quite nice. Like, I'm curious what you think of yours with the eye on potentially after that getting one. So kudos there, because I am a little surprised.
What's what everybody's complained about with this thing, without turning it all into the Remarkable 2, is that it's not good for reading books on, because I think a lot of people want to use it as an ebook reader as well as something to write on. But they'll fix that in a software update. But apparently, one of the things I like about it is, for example, when I'm when I'm creating content, for example,
an unutterable oaf, honestly.
I don't know why. I don't know why this bothers you so much. Anyway, so when I'm in the zone, making content, what I often do is I write, if I'm building a training course, for example, I'll write things down onto index cards, because then I can reorder them in different ways, right?
Hips and that's PDA one of the things territory. I like. Yep, carry
right,
on.
Exactly. And what I like about this Remarkable 2 is that, for example, I'd be able to write down some stuff on a card, and then you can select it and you can move it to a different notebook or a different part of the screen, or you can reorder things. So it goes a little bit beyond, obviously, what you can do with paper and a pen. By the way, I shared in our Slack channel that typewriter is called the FreeWrite. I want you both now,
this thing looks
listeners,
terrible.
Do this as well. Go to getfreewrite.com, and I want us all to experience this reaction together.
I looked at this.
Getfreewrite.com.
I will do it again for the purposes of
the lols.
of the lols, but I looked at it when you sent the link. And
I'm just waiting, waiting for Jeremy's.
So this is the opposite of the Remarkable 2. I look at this and think, I cannot believe anyone bought this.
It's so ugly as well. I mean,
I'll tell you what it is. Based on all these new things being e-versions of toys I had as a kid, it's a Speak and Spell. It looks like a Speak and Spell.
It does.
Except it's $700.
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't seen how much money it was.
$6.99. Quantities are limited. Only 150 of these beautiful freeware exist in the world. Make sure you capture yours today.
Oh, God. Now, that is annoying.
Yeah.
What's amazing to me is when you look at this thing, have you seen those? There's got a giant switch for the Wi-Fi to turn it off and on, which is kind of interesting. And then that folder switch, A, B, or C.
Yeah.
Three folders. It is just, what nincompoop came up with this idea?
I know. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible device. But yes, anyway, they'll send us one now for a review, and then we'll review it in like 2028. So, yes, I get your point. I think, I don't think that this is a new thing. So one of the things that we were talking about, one of the things this made me think about is this a trend? Is this something which is more common, or is it always there? To me, this feels like the idea of the backlash against technology, and you should be you should be writing things down on nice paper with a nice pen and things like that, seems to come up like every 2 or 3 years, to the point where I don't think it's a recurring trend. I think it just never goes away. It's there in the background the whole time.
There's always a grumbling in the background, isn't there? And then it becomes a crescent of grumbling. So
yeah, a crescendo, I think, rather than a crescent. But yeah,
that's a good point. Crescendo is the right word.
There's that, and there's also, I think, people are a little bit burned out on technology now, which probably is accelerating that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can believe that. I mean, do you remember when there was things like there was a little fad for distraction mode in editors, or non-distraction mode in editors, however you want it, where you had a simple stripped out text editor, which went full screen. And the pitch was then you're being sealed away from all the things clamoring for your attention. So you can just sit down and write. And again, those things are still around. Some people still use them. They still like them, but they had a little fillip of attention, 3 or 4 years ago. So I talked to my daughter about this because I thought it'd be interesting to see whether this was a generational thing.
Because how old is she?
She's 20.
She's 20, right.
So some of this felt like, to me, maybe it was us harking back to our youth a bit, because we're the only generation that's ever existed which straddled the division between no technology and technology, I think.
I think that was the generation before us.
Not tech, rather than no tech, but no one had used a computer on a regular basis until us. We remember a time before it, and now we exist after it. The generation after us haven't known a world without a computer on every desktop, like Bill Gates claimed for. And the generation before us still don't have one. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah,
the point was, I wonder whether this was our generation getting to the point where now we can make products and sell them to people. Mm. And yearning for the simplicity of our youth before social media and the internet came to destroy us. So I talked to Niamh, my daughter, and as far as I can tell, no, it isn't. her lot are basically the same. If you want to take a long series of notes about things, they'll use pen and paper because it's more comfortable to do. It's easier to sort of draw little lines and circles joining things up and so on. If you're keeping a to-do list, they'll do it on the phone, but there's no long typing there. And I think that's roughly the same as us, I believe. That, I mean, if I need to plan something out or sketch something out or make some quick notes, I'll do it on the notebook, which is next to my desk. If I'm doing something where I know I want to keep it, or it's going to eventually become a document, I'll probably do it in a text editor because I don't have to transcribe it.
From what I can tell, people her age and younger, say 15 to 20-ish, are more anti-technology than people our age, not less.
Yeah, if anything, yeah. But
really? Having grown up steeped in technology from the very beginning, I think they realize the dangers and the downsides a little. I think we're the generation, and I said this in a previous show, we're a little Pollyannish about tech, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I don't know that younger generations will be so Pollyannish.
I am, however, aware that I may be dealing with a biased sample here, because if I look at all the people in my generation,
my sample size of one, I'm willing to make certainties.
No. I mean,
the Bad Voltage polling department is not exactly experienced.
I have a large, sample set. The problem is, how many people do you know who aren't involved with technology? And the answer is not as many as people I know who are involved in technology.
Yes, for sure.
And I feel like my life would be different if I were a guy fixing a roof, for example. Might be sadder, but it would be.
We see, what's kind of interesting about that is that for me, you mentioned about Niamh preferring to use paper and a pen if it's like a longer piece of writing, because she probably doesn't want to type into her phone or whatever. For me, I actually really don't like writing a lot of content with a pen. I just find it annoying. So to give you an example, when I've been working on one of these training courses, the idea of coming up with the course and the content and how you order it and the, you know, how you kind of build the journey, I guess you could say, I find that way easier to do on paper and a pen because I can sketch things out. I can draw little diagrams. But then yeah, I think like you, Ak, once I've got that scribbled set of notes, then I'll move it into like a proper document where I formally write everything out and make it look.
But I don't think anyone writes anything longhand anymore. I wrote a letter a couple of years ago to Mr. Bacon and his wife.
This is true. Yeah.
And it was weird, you know, a 2-page paper letter. It felt bizarre. I hadn't written something that long in a long time. And I do a lot of writing on paper. I've got a notebook in my coat, which I move from things, and I've got 2 fountain pens and I've got 1 in each jacket. So I've always got them to write with, to make little notes with.
I cannot remember the last time I wrote a two full page note.
It was weird. No. I mean, it was a really nice experience, and I thoroughly recommend it to you. It does feel, honestly, quite slow and clunky. I can't write by hand as fast as I can type. Nowhere near. Not even close. So it feels frustrating, but it's sort of thing where if you want a sort of a chilled, slow moment, write something out longhand. It's nice.
So there's some interesting research, too, into if you physically write with a pencil, pen, paper, old school, you remember substantially more of what you're writing down than if you type it, which
is... I've heard about this, yeah. That's interesting.
It is.
So, I mean, I think we'd all agree that there's value to sitting down there with a paper and a pen. That I guess... And I think there is an element of... It is more tactile, but I think a big chunk of this is getting away from the distractions. Like, we've talked on the show previously about you know, these tools built into phones to reduce screen time and things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm increasingly of the view that, speaking personally, I don't use any of those things. I don't have anything on my computer that restricts how I use it, with the exception of one thing, which is one of those little micro breaks thing that locks my screen every 15 minutes for 1 minute. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I injured my rotator cuff and I need to do these stretches. And it's good to do that every 15 minutes. But beyond that, I don't have anything.
So do you disable that when we record, or disable it during meetings, or disable it? It seems like for me,
if I disabled it
during meetings, it would be disabled for 12 hours a day.
I leave it on and then you can dismiss it if you want to. It's like a screen overlay, and I dismiss it if I'm in a meeting. The time when I have to disable it is if I'm recording my screen, like doing a video or whatever. But that's the only thing I do to restrict it. And frankly, I spend so much of my life on a computer and sat in front of a phone and all the rest of it. But I do think that what's interesting, I think people struggle with being on a computer and not using the things that a computer or a phone can do, because that requires a lot of self-discipline. But picking up a piece of paper and a pen or a remarkable tablet or whatever and going and sitting in a different room away from it all, turning your phone off or leaving it in a different room, I find that works much better.
Which makes sense.
There is an interesting question, because I agree with you. If you're actually doing it on a piece of paper, at no point when you write something on that piece of paper will it pop up a little thing offering that you share it on Facebook, for example. But there's always been this promise of some kind of computer technology which gives you the experience that you're used to of things like writing on paper or filing things or whatever, but gives you the benefits that a computer has. Like, you can search it, you can print it out, you can make multiple copies, you can go back and edit it afterwards, so on and so forth. And that's the same pitch that the Remarkable 2 is doing. I will be interested to see is whether the Remarkable 2, or possibly the Remarkable 3, starts growing all of this crappy, now share this, now invite your friends to collaborate or something.
Exactly.
And once they start saying, this is going back to the last show, about companies wanting an ongoing revenue stream rather than the idea that they sell you a thing, they keep your money, and then nothing else happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not tied into a cloud service, I assume, yet.
They either do have it or they're building a way to sync your notes to thing.
Yeah, I'm sure that, but it doesn't require it, is the point.
No, not as far as I'm aware. I think you're right. Like, what I think is fascinating here about that topic is as we talked about a couple of shows ago, or maybe the last one, I can't remember, where everything is moving over to these SaaS services, right? Yeah. And I mean, I had it today. I use this tool called ConvertKit for my email, and they just added a new set of features into the service, which are pretty cool. And I guess what's interesting about the Remarkable too is, for that to maintain its value, they need to deliberately not add things. And then you've got to ask the question, some people might want all of that functionality, and that's a way in which they can add functionality and make it more sellable to people. But half the value here is that you don't have that sinking shit on there. It doesn't interrupt you.
You're not supposed to have a distraction-free text editor and then quietly turn it into Eclipse or Emacs or something in the background.
Sawinski's law.
Well, and this is exactly the point. But I think it is... There's something, and people, I've been reading, attempting to find people who've managed to articulate this well, and I haven't found anybody. But there is something nice, something compelling about that feeling of writing on paper, making notes on paper, that a computer just doesn't seem to capture. You know, and I like computers. I'll be honest with you. This might come as a surprise to you. But I like computers. Not. And I have spent some considerable time staring into a screen 18 hours a day since I was 4 years old. But yeah, I think there is still some interest in that. And like you say, Jeremy, I think the Generation Z and millennials tend to be withdrawing a bit from the whole technology thing exactly because they've had a life suffused in it and want something different. Like, wanting out of the water.
I mean, do we think this is going to continue? Because, I mean, we've talked about the Remarkable 2. There's color e-ink is becoming a thing now. We're starting to see color e-ink tablets coming out. And it's only a matter of... I mean... Yeah, you can go and buy them. I mean, it's only a matter of time before Amazon are going to put one in a Kindle.
It's jam tomorrow still. You know, in the same way that folding phones are and so on. Yeah, they're there.
You can buy them today.
But have you seen anyone using them?
But that doesn't mean that they're not available. It just means that people, I don't know, haven't got them. I don't know anyone with a... Lamborghini. Doesn't mean they don't exist in the world.
First of all, I don't believe you. Secondly,
one guy. You met him.
I know I've met him. That's why I said I don't believe you.
I forgot. Well, we don't know he's got a Lamborghini. He's got like 20 sports cars. He's probably going to have a Lambo in there.
I'm prepared to bet he's got half a dozen Lamborghinis, that bloke. But yeah, I mean, yes, you can go out and buy them, but I kind of expected that colour e-ink would take the world by storm and there'd be no black and white e-ink. In the same way that 15 minutes after Kali tellies came out, there weren't that many black and white tellies. And that has emphatically not been the case.
Well, it's still pretty new, to be fair.
Yes.
But people have been buying these tablet screen protectors for like iPads that where when you use the Apple Pencil, it feels more like paper instead of writing on a glass screen. Do we think that we're going to see more of this? Because the books thing is interesting to me, because there is something about, like, the reason why I've been buying books recently is I realized recently that I start a book and I'll read through it. And if it doesn't capture my interest within the first third of the book, I'll probably never read the rest of it. And then I realized this is stupid, especially for not so much fiction, but I don't read fiction, but more for business books or how-to books, something like that, where you can just... You can pick up a physical book and you can flick through it and go and find a bit that looks interesting. Maybe a diagram catches your eye or something like that. You can't do that easily on a Kindle. You can't flick through a Kindle. You can't browse. You can't flick through pages on a Kindle like you can with a real book. And I wonder whether we're going to start seeing more of that as well.
I think there's always going to be a kind of uneasy tension between them because they both bring things to the party, you know? Yes, I find it immensely useful. Just there's a whole bunch of, what do security people call it? Side channels. When you're reading a physical book, you have a sense of where you are in the book, how long there is to go in the book. And no matter how much the Kindle people would say, but there's a progress bar at the bottom. It's not the same. You take that sort of information in from a book without being consciously aware of it. Whereas with a Kindle, you've got to go looking for it. Like you say, flicking through a Kindle to see if there's anything interesting is really, really difficult. The flip side is, if I want to know where a thing is in a book and I can't remember, searching on a Kindle, super easy.
Yeah.
Looking through a paper book by hand, massive pain in the behind, having had to do it. I'm sitting here next to a bookshelf. So I read all the books on it, you know, so I read paper books a lot. And every now and again, I'll think of something And even if I know roughly where it is in the book, sometimes I can jump pretty quickly to it. But sometimes if I can't find it, then finding it is hell on legs. What I end up doing is picking a sentence from the book, Googling that sentence in quotes, at which point I find some dodgy knockoff Russian website with the plain text of a book I own and have in my hand, and then search that for the text that I want, right? And this seems like a suboptimal way of interacting with the content that I've been presented with.
There's a lot of dodgy Russian book websites. I have a Google alert set up for people powered.
And oh, really?
And it's like almost every Google alert that I get is some dodgy Russian forum with people who've ripped off my book and they're sharing it. It's like
it's all publicity, right?
I guess.
I mean, this is one of those things where it is, but I suspect you probably ought to say that out loud, otherwise you get a phone call from HarperCollins or whatever going, dude, stop saying things like that. We don't care what Cory Doctorow says.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. So any other thoughts on this before we wrap this delicious show up?
I'm going to quote Rupert Childs from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
Because, as with everything real is in Buffy. So this is 20 years ago. And he said books smell musty and rich, and the knowledge gained from a computer, it has no texture. It's got no context. It's there and it's gone. If it's to last, then the getting of knowledge should be tangible. And I think that's exactly what you were saying, Jeremy, about things like writing things by hand makes it actually sink into your memory. And computer stuff is ephemeral. It's not fixated. It's not fixed within you in quite a way. And I thought that was...
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's whoever wrote that script, that line, obviously perceived that. And that was 22 years ago, probably.
Would you agree that that's great content?
I'd agree that it was great.
I would like to do a show one time that's just where each I think we may have done this, but I want you, Mr. Langridge, to pick out the five things, like Room 101, you know, that TV show in England.
Oh wow, yeah.
Room 101 of the five things that just infuriate you. And obviously, you know, content is one thing that infuriates you. There's probably more things.
If I had to talk a lot about content, I would be discontent.
Oh, he's here all week. Try the veal. So I would love to hear what our community have got to say about this, because I think it's one thing that surprised me when we talked about this and we were planning out this show was I thought I was alone as somebody who sits there with pencils and paper coming up with ideas, and you both said yeah we do that. And I remember posting a picture to Twitter where I was doing something and I had paper in the picture, and you know, a bunch of people said old school and a bunch of other people said no, I do this all the time too. I'd like to know whether our audience fits into that bucket, because I bet more people are like this than we might think.
So what I found interesting about my particular usage patterns, I thought about them a little bit more deliberately than I normally do for this show, and I realized, so when I read a book, I almost exclusively read books on Kindle. I like that I can hear about a book, order it, read it immediately. I cannot remember, outside of a couple of books that I ordered more for the aesthetic. So like the Randall Monroe wrote a book where it just lent itself to physical form. Or like there's that really cool Aviary cookbook. Those books, I bought the book. But other than the aesthetic books, I have not purchased a
physical artifacts.
It's art,
Other than that, I can't remember the last time I bought a book to read. But I subscribe to a bunch of magazines and don't subscribe to any of them on any digital media. I only get the physical magazine and thoroughly enjoy reading the physical magazine. So like The Economist I get, but I look forward to reading it. Barron's I get, but I look forward to reading it. So I don't know why there's such a disconnect between books and not books mentally for me, but it's a very bright line, stark difference that I didn't fully appreciate until I thought about this show.
Yeah.
I was going to say that's interesting, because Eric and I were chatting the other night about this, because I was just saying to her, you know, she had the same experience, but in America, that I remember many fond memories as a kid living opposite a news agent's in the town, in the little village that we lived in, and subscribing to three or four different magazines. And they were primarily about video games and rock
Input,
music.
Input, Electron User.
Right. And the excitement of going over to the shop to pick up my, you know, the new issue and the smell of it.
Go and get Dragon magazine. Absolutely. Yeah.
And going and sitting down and just pouring through. I'd read it paid like cover to cover. And you don't yet to the example, your quote, like you don't get that with computer stuff.
You don't. It's incredibly useful. And I don't know that I'd give up having all the knowledge of the world at my fingertips just to have a very, very, very tiny subset of it, but on paper. But it was nice. And an awful lot of people seem to feel this, but it's hard to articulate.
Yeah,
I think I've not found anyone who's managed to describe it in a way which seems to capture how I feel about it. It's a very difficult feeling to get a handle on. So this is why we're interested in, you know, the listenership's thoughts. So ping us on Slack or on the forum or whatever, or if you want to, send us a letter.
It's Bad Voltage PO Box.
show@badvoltage.org.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we shall wrap this up. And any final words, Mr. and Mrs. Langridge?
No.
And Garcia? Made no sense whatsoever. All right. I think we're done.
Such a muppet.
Bye, everyone.